Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Canisa linda tengo en mi vida, huevo. Canisa linda tengo en mi vida, huevo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo. Canisa linda tengo en mama, na papa. Canisa linda tengo en mama, na papa. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo, 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 yo. Yo.
We are going to continue to move in the series of Ruth, reflecting on Scripture in this way. So this is just a brief video that tells the story of Ruth chapter 2. So let's watch.
In chapter 1, we learn about where Ruth came from. A man named Elimelech marries a woman named Naomi in the town of Bethlehem. They have two sons, and they all travel to Moab during a famine. Elimelech dies, and the two sons marry women from Moab. One marries Orpah, the other marries Ruth. Those two men die in Moab, and Naomi decides to return to Bethlehem. Orpah returns to her family, but Ruth travels with Naomi back to Bethlehem. Chapter 2 begins with Ruth asking Naomi if she could go and glean from the fields. To glean means to go into other people's fields and gather the grain that was accidentally left behind by the harvest workers. This was generally done by the poor, the foreigner, and the widow. As Ruth is gleaning, she comes across a field belonging to a man named Boaz. He was a righteous man from the same clan as Ruth's father-in-law, Elimelech, who had died. As Boaz is going through his fields, he notices Ruth and asks one of his workers about her. The man responds, "She's the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi. She asked if she could glean here and has been working since early morning, except for a short rest." Boaz then says to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Stay and glean with the women here on these fields. Don't go to anyone else's. These men won't harm you, and when you are thirsty, you may drink the water that my workers have." Ruth falls to her face, bowing to him, and saying, "Why have I found favor in your eyes? I'm a foreigner." Boaz responds, "I've heard about your situation. I've heard that your husband has died, but that you chose to leave your family, friends, and country to stay with your mother-in-law in a foreign land. May the Lord bless you for this." Ruth is very thankful and goes back to gleaning. At mealtime, Boaz calls to her and brings her to the table of the workers to eat and drink with them. She ate until she was full and even had leftovers, which she saved. When she goes back to work, Boaz tells his workers to let her glean even in places that they haven't harvested, and don't rebuke her for it. He even tells them to leave some extra grains of wheat for her. At the end of the day, Ruth goes home with about an ephah of barley, which is about 5.5 gallons, enough to feed two women for at least 2 weeks, and she tells Naomi about Boaz, the man who owns the field. Naomi informs her that Boaz is a close relative of theirs, and tells Ruth to stay with Boaz and work only in that field. So Ruth gleaned in the field belonging to Boaz until the end of the harvest, and continued living with her mother-in-law, Naomi.
what's your middle name? Do you hate your job? Do you fall in love too easily? What's your favorite word? You like kissing girls. Can I call you baby? Yeah. Says that people stare 'cause we look so good together. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't change even if I try, even if I wanted to. I can't change even if I.
So I wanted to start by thanking Matt and Linda for allowing me this opportunity, and Chris, thank you for asking me to come share some words with you all this morning. I really do want this higher. Let's do that. How can I do that? Okay, thanks. So I want to start by explaining a little bit about what I study. Thank you, sir. Whenever I tell people I'm getting a PhD in religious studies, they think I'm some sort of Bible expert. Rest assured, I actually know very little about the Bible. In fact, when Linda and Matt asked me about doing a sermon on Ruth, I thought, whoa, women get their own books in the Bible now. And I have a note here that says, how you all like that joke will really like change the way the next half hour goes. So, you see, instead of being a Bible expert, I'm a cultural critic and historian who looks closely at how Christians live out the Bible as they understand it. In other words, I come to places just like this, I sit in the back, and I judge each and every one of you silently in my head, and I take notes along the way. Specifically, I look at how people build both Christian churches and Christian beliefs, and how these structures act out as boundaries, preventing other types of people and other types of ideas from entering. See, the premise of that joke was that over time, Christians and Bible editors have done a pretty solid job at erasing the presence of women from scholarship, and those acts have reduced women to a second class in many Christian communities. While I look at many social issues and concerns, my project specifically focuses on race and the many ways that white culture, as the dominant Christian culture historically, has created and maintained these boundaries, both historically and in today's society. These boundaries include the ways people sing and worship, the ways people are in community together, the beliefs the church has regarding others, and the ways in which the church responds to local and international need, and the list goes on. So now, without knowing anything about me, you might be asking yourself how I, as a white, middle class, exceedingly heterosexual, tall drink of water you see before you, got to thinking about such thoughts regarding church. He's so clearly privileged and is reaping the benefits of the system. Why would he bother, you might be asking? Well, let me tell you a few stories. So my background is this. Upon my first job out of college, I was making more money alone than my parents ever made together in their whole lives. And at that small nonprofit in a low-ranking position, I think you can understand, I was not exactly raking it in, right? When we were kids, my dad would get paid every Friday, and so we'd have a check in hand, but it would not be in the bank at that time, so we'd sort of like have the access to the money, but wouldn't have it deposited, right? And so every Friday, we would order Pizza Hut pizza. I'm looking at my sister to see if she remembers this story. And we would order Pizza Hut pizza, and we didn't actually have the money to be ordering the Pizza Hut pizza. We would just also write a check for Pizza Hut pizza, and then hopefully the two would clear the bank at the same time without the Pizza Hut check clearing before the actual deposit check. So that's how poor we were. I praise my parents for their resourcefulness. Poor people are some of the craftiest people you will ever meet, because we never went deeply hungry. But I can recall many more times in which we were having to borrow money from this person or that person to pay this bill or that bill before this utility or that utility got shut off. By most measures of the word, our six-member family was broke. So that's one aspect. Another aspect. When I was young, there was absolutely no hiding the fact that I was gay. Because of this, my coming out story is one of the more uneventful parts of my life. My mom, being one of only two people that actually asked me if I was gay during the coming out process, she told me, "Joey, I've known since you were two. I've loved you the whole time, and I'm not going to stop loving you now." And that was that. My whole family pretty much followed suit after that. And I always love telling that story about my mom. She's since passed, and that's the story I reflect on most of all when I think about how much of an ally and amazing support she was for me in my life, and how easy she made my coming out story, which, as I've talked to Matt Linda about, is, as we all know, very rare. And I'm very thankful for her for that. The more interesting thing about my gay identity has been my life since my late high school, early college days. I guess all those social markers of my gay identity got hidden behind my ability to grow a beard and my love of plaid. I feel very much the same, if not even more comfortable with myself. Yet, I've had to come out more in my early 30s than I ever did in my 20s. I also stopped wearing these bright pastel yellow pants that I used to wear rolled up at the bottom, like capris, so that also might have something to do with it. But I can also name every drag queen that ever appeared on RuPaul's Drag Race, so I actually don't know what it is. That's true. You should test me on that later. So another part of my identity is I have less to say about this particular topic because I have a belly and I will yank a clean piece of chocolate chip cookie right out of the hand of a small child when parents aren't looking. But when I was younger, I used to say 80 pounds. Now it's more like 70 pounds heavier. Please hold your applause. It's been about 10 years since then, but I still remember people not recognizing me, being hit on by people who did not give me the time of day before my weight loss, and the general invisibility that many people with obesity report experiencing. Another part of my identity. I grew up in the biggest Mexicanist family that I know. As far as stereotypes go, my family could have been the subject of one of those telenovelas Matt mentioned last week. Each of my parents had 5 siblings. Each of their parents had 5 siblings. I have 25 first cousins, innumerable second cousins, and an undisclosed amount of neighbor kids that are probably cousins, and so much love in one family that my heart could burst just thinking about it. I didn't know I was white until I moved out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I'm from, to Denver, Colorado in 2009. I guess after reading this, it implies that I was the white kid in a Mexican family. No, my family is Mexican, and I'm also Mexican. I didn't know I was white until I moved to Denver in 2009. My white skin had never been in such stark contrast to my brown heart before that moment. I would hear little whispers of racism from time to time that, to the speaker, were just harmless observations. Once I was with some friends, and one of their buddies just started trashing on Mexicans. My brown insides were boiling to the point where I stopped him, and I said, "Dude, I'm Mexican." At which point he tells me, "Oh, no, 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 not you, dude. No, no, no. You're cool. I'm talking about the other kind." Okay, yeah, get mad. That's annoying. You see, it wasn't until that very moment when my identity became crystallized. In New Mexico, one of the bigoted things Latinos do is attempt this false hierarchy of Latinoness. The supposed order of power was Spanish on top, usually families that had been in New Mexico for hundreds of years, despite many of those people also being short and brown, a clear marker of at least some indigenous mixing, right? Below that were Mexicans that had been in the States for a few generations, but who tended to identify as Mexican nationals. And below that were newly arrived Mexicans. As someone who is relatively tall and who is as white as the day is long, it would be easy for me to hop on the white privilege train and ride out with this dude's comments as though they didn't affect me. But my heart wouldn't allow it. Allowing this guy to go unchecked would have been participating on the wrong side of racism in that moment. What other kind was he talking about? The brown kind? The short kind? The Spanish-speaking kind? My brother is brown. My auntie is short and brown. My grandma is short, brown, and Spanish-speaking. So I grabbed that dude by the collar. I drew him in, and I said, "Hey, ese, you're lucky my tios and primos aren't here to help me show you what kind of Mexican I am." And I threw him to the ground. Okay, that didn't happen. But the fact that I even thought of it should prove to you just how Mexican I am on the inside. Throughout my life, I have been crossing boundaries back and forth and sometimes back again in several cases. Because of this, I have been given the gift of seeing from multiple sides of many issues. What are your stories of boundary crossing? What experiences has God given you that allow you to see from other perspectives? What opportunities have you had to see from other perspectives that you have maybe ignored or not paid enough attention to? What boundary might be revealing itself to you in your life right now that is begging your attention? There was a collective sigh I felt just now in the room. Think about that. Allow me a little room to first complain about something else I've learned throughout my studies. Many narratives in the Bible, including Ruth and even Jesus himself, are beautiful, sometimes heart-wrenching, always compelling stories of suffering. But let's be clear, though. Historically speaking, American Christianity is pretty much as privileged as a faith tradition and institution can get. Christianity is imprinted on our state houses, in our schools, on our money, and no president thus far has ever been anything but a devout Christian. Right on down to number 45 himself, 2 Corinthians. That's a joke for some of you. Thank you, Linda. I can explain that one later. When we reflect on the stories of suffering about which we read, allow me to challenge you first with this question. How much more change could we experience when we grapple with our heart's tendency to be more like Orpah than Ruth? To be more like Judas than Jesus? When we as Christians accept the challenge to see ourselves as the selfish ones and not just the selfless ones? Or to be those that cause suffering and not just as those who suffer? We will make our first steps towards seeing from the other side of those boundaries. My former professor, Dr. Jane Vernard, calls this practice holding both. When we can live in the tension of both, we can truly make spiritual change. Are you with me? Okay. My anxiety is rising a little bit. Okay, now that our wills are turning a bit regarding boundaries, let's turn our attention to the story of Ruth. In my mind, the story of Ruth provides us, the readers, with rich examples of what happens when we settle our fears and expound our boundaries, or our limits, in ways that are inclusive and diverse. In ways that are life-giving to those around us and not life-taking. Like so many boundaries can be. To me, this is the very point of life. We are meant to experience God and do our best to share that experience of God with others. Therefore, God reveals God's truest self through the diversity of life in stories just like the ones found in Ruth. The clearest boundary God seems to be asking us to expand is the one that occurs between nations. So let's start there. Ruth 1:22 states, "So Naomi returned together with Ruth to the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back to her from the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley festival." So historically, in the Jewish tradition, Ruth is read during the harvest festival called Saviot. This story reminds its Jewish listeners that God accepts Ruth into the Jewish faith and culture. Ruth's work during the harvest allows God to demonstrate how much God desires to care for all people who need caring for. It's thought of as a way to remind people that God cares for both the Jew and the Gentile, for the local and the foreigner, for both the light and dark-skinned people. Do you see where I'm going with this? Much like in the Jewish tradition, let's allow ourselves to revisit this story every once in a while and remember to open up our boundaries that get more and more narrow throughout the year. Allow us to incorporate the acceptance of others as a spiritual practice. getting better and more succinct in our efforts each go-around. And don't forget, I'll be judging you and making sure that you know it. Going further, Boaz allows us to see the embodiment of this same idea of border expanding. In chapter 2, he said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Keep your eyes on the field that is being reaped and follow behind them. I have ordered the young men not to bother you. If you get thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." Boaz was what us Mexicans like to call rich. I think white people say comfortable or doing well for himself. Boaz was rich. Boaz was like that rich cousin whose good side you had to stay on because they sent you birthday cards with money. Boaz had money and he employed many people. Boaz used his abilities and social status to influence the life of both Ruth and Naomi. And let's not forget, as Matt talked about last week, that the Moabites and the Israelites were always at odds. Boaz, a local, used his financial and social position to go against cultural norms to support Ruth, an immigrant, during her transition into this, her new land, God's land. How do you feel about helping to resettle people? About immigration? Any room within your heart to allow your boundaries to be expanded within your own life and within your own political and cultural views? That makes room for the Ruths and Naomis that are around right here and now. Is your heart open to sharing of your resources, your political power, your sympathies? And even more challenging still is thinking about where your heart is closed off to these outsiders. Going a little deeper, we find relationships between family members as another example of how we can expand our boundaries. Let's talk a little bit about Naomi. Naomi, my homie, I like to call her. We see back to the second chapter of Ruth. Ruth said to Naomi, in other words, Ruth asked Naomi. In my culture, you don't say to an older woman, you ask of an older woman, unless you want to get slapped. So Ruth asked, very humbly and politely, we'll say, of Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she went and came and gleaned the field behind the reapers. As it happened, she came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was in the family of Elimelech. Let's be clear about one thing. Naomi is the real executor of this plan. She is devout and constantly developing feminist. I love seeing moments in the Bible where women shine. Naomi, my homie, reminds me of many older Latinas in my life that have blessed me with wisdom, experience, and gentle guidance. Naomi reminds me of that one tia that just always knows best, and we all have that one. Naomi encouraged Ruth to challenge the notion that she didn't belong, to step out with bravery, to make something better for her life. She used her connections to guide her kin toward an opportunity for success. Naomi saw a spark of courage in Ruth and fanned it into a flame. Are you the Naomi of your family? Do you encourage your siblings, your partner, your children to go after their heart's desires? Are you like the culture that makes people like Ruth afraid? What would your family say about you? On which side would they place you? Naomi gives us an example of ways to look at a journey. Her wisdom allows us to take pause and reflect on our own journey and the journey of others and be encouraged. She pushes us to move beyond that boundary of fear or that boundary of having confidence and not knowing which first step to take. She tells us, "Go, my child." She reminds us that when we take steps in faith, we are able to cross that boundary, that container, that that limit, or of fear, and move toward knowing ourselves and the world around us, and ultimately God, even better than we do now. The deepest boundary that I see is the one within our own hearts. Much like we learned last week, Boaz was the pull and Naomi was the push that we need for change. Where does that leave you? Ruth is a story not just about boundaries. It is also a story that makes us think about our perceptions of boundaries. To think about who we are letting surround us and who we are keeping out in that decision. Ruth is poor. Ruth is a woman. Ruth is a foreigner. Where is your heart stirring to open up the boundary line? How are the ways that you think about the world affecting others? Are you creating limitations or sharing fear for others? Are you the culture that's encouraging Ruth to stay in her place? Or are you the Boaz and the Naomi, my homie, pushing and pulling others beyond their perceived limits, encouraging people to create change? Are you taking that extra ounce of energy to see things from another perspective? Are you saying, "Go, my child"? I want to encourage all of you to continue striving to see from the other side, to cross that boundary of fear and move into a space where you hold and value and honor the stories of others. It's the act of holding both that allows us the safety and freedom we need to take those steps and gain the experience that it allows us to see and to be more like God to the world. Amen? Thank you.
Chick-a-lele, 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 chick-a-lele.